This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Dr. Davy Smith is conducting one of the dozens of clinical trials now in progress across the country to find a cure, not a preventative vaccine, for the coronavirus. He is a professor of medicine and chief of infectious diseases and global public health at the University of California, San Diego. Davy earned his biology degree from this campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Davy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You are from this area and you are a graduate of this campus, UTC.
That's correct. Go Mocs. Yeah, so I grew up in Middle Valley, Tennessee. My parents still live there and my brother still lives in Chattanooga. And I went to Red Bank High School and then I went to University of Tennessee, Chattanooga and was a biology major and graduated in 1993. From UTC, I went to East Tennessee State University up in Johnson City. That's where I went to medical school. And then after that, I did my residency in San Diego, and then stayed on to do my fellowship in infectious diseases at UC San Diego, stayed on as faculty.
And how long have you been in your current role?
I became the chief of the division in 2016. I'm a translational virologist, which is an infectious disease physician. So I see patients with infectious diseases, and mostly my research in the area has been around viruses. So hepatitis C, HIV has probably been my biggest area of interest. And then once COVID hit, I started working in that area. What a translational virologist means is that I have a lab, so a laboratory that does lots of research using clinical samples and then trying to figure out new things to take that back into clinical practice.
And when did you sense that what has unfolded was going to be as serious as it is?
I had a good inkling that we were going to be in the trouble with another viral pandemic about the beginning of January. So if my parents and I and my husband were out doing a cruise in Australia for a vacation when we heard the reports that there was a new respiratory virus that was similar to SARS coronavirus at the end of December, the beginning of January. Since it was being spread respiratory-wise and it was being spread widespread, I knew that it wasn't long going to be contained in China. So it was soon going to get out and probably already had by the time that I had gotten home.
And then tell us more about your work there in San Diego these past months.
Once I got back home, everything changed. We started working very quickly in the lab trying to figure out how the virus attacked the immune system, how the immune system attacked the virus. San Diego was one of the first places that got people off the cruise ships. Luckily, our cruise ship wasn't infected, but other cruise ships were. And with those people were quarantined here in San Diego. So we had direct access to those passengers. So we got lots of samples there. And from those samples, we were able to figure out how the virus evaded the host immune responses. And that basically has led the foundation for what many of the vaccines are now tackling. The next step that we did is that I was very interested in trying to find new treatments for COVID. We applied to the NIH to start a trial using the infamous now hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin. It took a while, it took basically too long to get that up and running, and it just politics got in the way and that made that untenable. But the next step that we did, because we were able to set it up on our end pretty quickly, the NIH said, we want you to run an even bigger trial. And that trial was part of what we call Operation Warp Speed, which is a national government program to really get clinical trials together to fight the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So I was tapped to be the lead on the program called ACTIV-2. And that specific program is to find new treatments that help people when they first get the virus to keep them from getting sick. So keep them from going into the hospital and dying. And that trial now has about 30 some odd sites across the US. We hope to get another 60 sites up and running, and then trying to open up new sites across the world in South Africa, India, Brazil, et cetera.
A lot of talk about when we might see a vaccine. You and your colleagues have to be very realistic, very careful, very methodical before even engaging in that talk yourselves, let alone with the rest of us in the public. What should people keep in mind as they see headlines suggesting, they see people speculating about what might happen when?
Yeah, it's all sound and fury at the moment, which drives everybody a little bit crazy, and especially on the science side of it. Here's my best advice. On the vaccine, we absolutely need a vaccine. Things are working very quickly to get a vaccine. I think the scientists who are in charge of those trials will rigorously test the safety and efficacy of those vaccines, and hopefully politics doesn't get in the way to push out something too soon. So that's one. The other thing that I think people should know is that we don't necessarily, I want a vaccine, I will take a vaccine when it's effective and safe, but we don't necessarily need just a vaccine to get out of this pandemic. We can also borrow from what we know with HIV. In the HIV world, we don't have a vaccine. What we have are really good treatments, really good biomedical interventions that keep people alive who have the infection. But also, when people are treated, they don't spread that infection to others. So in that sense, our trial that's trying to find these new therapies for SARS-CoV-2 could be used in exactly the same way. And I think those therapies, we'll probably have our first generation of therapies probably in November, December. And that really will change the tide of how we're able to operate in society. Once we have those therapies, you could think of, I get exposed, I take the therapy, I don't have a risk of getting into the hospital or dying anymore. And that really is a game changer for what we can fight this pandemic.
And it's a sort of game changer that is meant to be prepared for if there is another wave, if there is a mutation, various scenarios.
Yeah, well, let's just play it out. Let's say the FDA has said that they're going to allow a vaccine that is 50% effective to be approved. If the vaccine is 50% effective, I will take it. But that means when I'm exposed in the hospital, and I see patients in the hospital all the time, if I'm exposed, then I still have a 50% chance of getting it. I still need a therapy to keep me from getting sick. And I think that really does need to be added into the equation of how we fight the virus.
And we say that there needs to be a therapy added. Break that down a bit more for people.
So what we're looking for are new drugs that are directly targeted towards the coronavirus so that when somebody gets exposed, you could take that medication and it will keep them from going on to an infection. Or if they're already infected, that medication would then keep them from getting sick enough to where they'd have to go in the hospital on a ventilator or even dying. And those are the therapies we're testing now.
And meantime, there are other things out there that people have to protect themselves against, including, especially this time of year, and we're talking about the flu, and we're talking about the need for people to get their flu shot.
That's right. So this fall is going to be very, very hard for us infectious disease docs because the flu is coming, but not just the flu. There are a whole bunch of viruses that circulate at the end of the year in the wintertime, adenovirus, other coronaviruses, flu, respiratory syncytial virus. All of these are in our community, and all of these spring up during the wintertime when we're indoors and it's colder outside, and they all basically look the same. So somebody comes in with fever, cough, shortness of breath, I'm going to be left wondering, is this the flu? Is this SARS-CoV-2? Is this a regular coronavirus, et cetera? So what we can do to lessen all of that is to get the vaccine for the one thing that we know works really well is the flu vaccine. And that'll help everyone coming this flu season.
And if people want more information about the work that you do, where can they go online?
RiseAboveCOVID, one word, .org. So RiseAboveCOVID.org.
All right, Davey, thanks so much.
Thanks, Ray.
Let's talk about the arts and outdoor learning. Bruce Blum has seen it all in action. He is a board member of the Arts-Based Collaborative here at UTC, ABC at UTC. Bruce, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tell us how you first got involved with what is now the Arts-Based Collaborative here at UTC.
I was a friend and colleague of Angela Dittmar, who's been recruited into the program to help with the collaborative that is developing programs for instilling within the community and in the school systems throughout our region an element of art-based learning, which is dearly missing in many, many schools. They flat out don't have one. Extremely valuable to the development of youngsters as they take in information about the world around them the art component is an experiential learning. And I'm a big believer in that experiential learning, as well as outdoor elements and nature as a part of that. So I think I'm one of about 10 board members, and I seem to have that unique quality that they like, is a lot of outdoor elements that can be integrated in with the arts program.
What drew you to the outdoors?
Ever since my earliest days, and I think that's why this rings so true to me, formative, very formative early days of being a kid, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, all the way up through my teenage years. The time I spent outdoors still rings very true. When I'm outside, I remember things. I remember what I developed within my own person as far as the ability to think creatively and be confident with who I am. Everything seems to integrate with that formative base of being outside and being creative in the outdoors as I grew up.
And when we talk about outdoor learning integrated with the arts, what does that mean to you?
Well, I guess the best way I can talk about that is an example. Angela and I this year, in two occasions, used a curriculum of arts-based learning that was used in our effort down at the Little Miss Mag Learning Center, Early Learning Center. And it involved teaching the youngsters, 2, 3, 4 year olds, what it's like to be in the outdoors and see plants grow. And in particular, we used a sweet potato as an exhibit, together with just doing the seed planting and the growing and the watering. Angela developed a puppet show and some musical elements and some artistic elements that all the children got to participate in and bring to life the idea of what a sweet potato is from a very, very small seed. As it grows, they tasted it. They were able to watch it as it developed into a final product as the season went on. So in the fall, when it came time to harvesting, they knew what they planted and they dug with their fingers and they excavated those sweet potatoes out. And you can't even imagine the sight of their eyeballs when they found those underneath. It was like a treasure hunt. But along the way, they learned about how the leaves grow, how the plant needs sun, where the water is provided to the plant in order for it to grow. And they watched it, they sang about it, they drew it. There were all sorts of physical elements of learning that surrounded that whole experience. And then it became an outdoor experience, which was much to my liking.
You bring a unique lens to this because of your work in healthcare.
Yeah. And that's an easy one to jump off on. We, as human beings, over the life of our generation, more and more have enclosed ourselves. And I say that we're oftentimes in our work, in our days, in our living, are really not outside very often. And I think that's a piece of our natural being that we're missing. And so that's the outdoor piece. The arts piece, I think, is so important because it exercises another part of our brain, our spirits, that in the chop-chop world of digital scheduling and red light, green light, and got to be here, got to be there, that's missing. Not just for us, but for our children. And so in every aspect of our daily life, to have that time for your prefrontal cortex to relax and allow the rest of your spirit, mind, body, and brain to exercise creatively is, I think if you do some legwork, and I've done plenty, you'll find that it's drastically missing. I'll give you an example. There's a book out there called The Nature Fix by a brilliant author, in my opinion, named Florence Williams. And part of her work was making her way over to Korea, which is one of the most recent first world countries to develop. In other words, the United States was well along the way when Korea came online and took their agrarian society into the modern. And they're having virtually a crisis with their youth over there in the way that none of those creative outdoor elements of growing, everything's bookwork, it's precision, it's science, it's digital. There's a very deep problem that the government has recognized within their early age youth, and they're actually doing some nature medical therapies for children over there. So there's a large amount of what we need to do as society to ensure that we have that ability to exercise other parts of us. And that's where the Arts-Based Collaborative is reaching out to all schools within our region, 17 counties, to help their teachers develop what is missing in their curriculum with the assistance of the staff there at the UTC.
And that sense of what has been missing has only been underscored by the pandemic, especially with students having to stay home and learn remotely, parents who have been told to stay home and work remotely, less and less time to be outside, more and more time stuck in boxes, that being the rooms of a house, or looking at other boxes as we are now looking at each other on a Zoom screen.
Yes, and it's been a two-edged sword. From that standpoint, if you're in the academic world, that's been kind of a very true statement, whether you be a student or a teacher. Less time with your colleagues, less time with in-person experiences. On the other hand, there's been some really exciting developments, and people have, I think in general, said, I got to get outside. State parks are flooded with new visitors, and it's almost amazing. People naturally, to your point, it was going the wrong direction, and then all of a sudden we got plowed into this stay inside mandate. It's very difficult on everyday ordinary people such as myself.
And what do you think is the next horizon for this outdoor learning that you've been talking about, integrated with the arts and organizations such as the Arts Based Collaborative here at UTC?
I think they're into it. The program they are currently partnered with is the Wolf Trap Studios up in Washington, D.C. And there's a tremendous center of expertise up there in terms of bringing curriculum and teaching curriculum to teachers within the 17 counties that surround us. More time on that, more support for that will be, I think, the next phase of what needs to happen. More time in the outdoors, more time with the arts-based integration of your curriculum. A little less time on some of the other structural things that we have tended to think are quite important. And I'm not going to get into the whole testing and educational system of standardized testing that's out there. I wish I could say I really understood the pluses and minuses as well as some other people do, but I do know one thing, and one thing that's missing is more of that kind of time that we're talking about.
And for people who want to follow what the Arts-Based Collaborative here at UTC is doing, they can go to utc.edu/arts-based-collaborative. If people want to follow what you're doing, if they want to connect with you, where can they go online?
Yeah, well, with that access, you'll get a hold of the board information. And we are, like I said, about a dozen board members who come from different disciplines. And we're really supporting a very small staff with Lori and Angela and some others to help make their job more robust and help leverage their efforts out there in the communities. So by all means, if someone wanted to get in touch with me, I'd be glad to provide some information and access. So you feel free to get my email there too, if you'd like to. Bruce.blohm, B as in boy, L-O-H-M as in Mary, @gmail.com. Love to talk about these things, so I'd be happy to entertain anybody's interest.
All right, Bruce, thanks so much.
Ray, thank you, and thank you for what you do for our community.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Tabi Upton is a counselor, writer, and media personality here in Chattanooga. Recently, she facilitated an artistic series hosted by Rise Chattanooga called The Soul of a Woman, focused on mental health for women and people of color, examining poetry, rhythms, writers, and musicians. I spoke with her earlier this month. Tabi, thanks for joining us.
It is great to be here.
We have to start with your beginnings as a counselor.
Yes, in my previous life, I was a counselor. I am still a licensed professional counselor, or AKA would be LPC here, for about 15 years worked as a counselor, first with children and then with adults and children. And I've worked in mental health centers as well as private practice, as well as with the military as a third-party contractor. And so I worked on military bases in Europe and in Central America, or actually the Caribbean. And that was quite an experience. And also worked in a jail before as well as a counselor. And so that part of my life still informs a lot of what I do in media. And it's been really amazing to see how you can wrap that around almost any career, really, as well. So,
and you are from this area?
I am. I grew up in Chattanooga, and during my middle school years, I actually lived in Ray County up in the country. My parents worked at a camp and retreat center, but then we came back to Chattanooga, and I graduated from high school here. But I also have a passion for travel, so went to school in California and Colorado, was a Peace Corps volunteer, and moved around to other countries, traveled to other countries, and then would come back. Came back for a while, then left again, and then came back again.
I know what that's like.
Yes, you can relate to that. I know you're from other places.
That's true.
Well, you're from Chattanooga.
That's right. That's right. And you mentioned the Peace Corps. You spent your service with the Peace Corps in Senegal.
I did. Yes. While you've done your homework. Yes, I, right after college, joined the Peace Corps. Basically, because I wanted to live in Africa. I wanted to see what that would be like. I wish I had a deeper goal of development, you know, things to do. But I was young and I just wanted to see the world. And so I joined the Peace Corps, and wow, did it teach me a whole lot. I was just talking about the Peace Corps too, but yeah, it taught me a lot. I lived in a Muslim country as a Christian, really learned what it meant to be an outsider, you know, but to yet be welcomed in to a different culture, and just what it takes. It takes so much psychologically to do that. So I really have a heart for people coming to the U.S. and trying to make it in another culture. It is a difficult thing, but very enriching. So I learned a lot during that time. Have some crazy stories to tell as well. Hitchhiking and all kinds of stuff that went on during that time. That I don't recommend, but you know.
What's something that surprised you from your time there?
In the Peace Corps, you know what I was surprised by? People often think about places like Africa as dangerous based on the media that we get about it. And usually that's going to be about a war happening or a famine happening. But in the Peace Corps in Senegal, the time I was there, was an extremely peaceful country, and the respect people had for one another was so great that they would not allow you. Part of the culture with travel was that sometimes a person might be taking you from one place to another, but decide, I'm not going to be able to take you the whole way, so I'm going to bring you this far and give the rest of your fare to another driver who'll take you the rest of the way. Because I lived in a village that was 10 hours from the capital. And so when I went to the capital, it was a long way, it was a long trip. And so I didn't understand what they were doing at first, and I got really upset about it. But what I learned is that they would never strand a person. If they had to take you home with them and you spend the night with their family and they feed you themselves and give you a place to sleep, they would do that before they would ever leave somebody stranded. I learned that because I actually had to stay with, sometimes we were stranded just from errors that we made in our travel. Like for instance, I was traveling in West Africa in another country with some friends, and we thought we were going to meet up with some Americans who actually were not there when we got there. And if it weren't for the kindness of strangers who actually took us into their home, gave us their own bed and fed us dinner, we would have been sleeping on the street. We were that far out. And so the safety of that, the safety of hitchhiking. I hitchhiked sometimes without really meaning to, was just kind of out somewhere and needed to get somewhere, had to go with a stranger, never harmed. The one time I did have an altercation, it was with someone who had some mental problems. And that was the reason that there was an issue. But otherwise, the people, out of respect for you and the culture, would not dare harm a person. I think that was a huge surprise, because in our culture, it's very different.
As we have been reminded again and again and again, especially this year, in many different ways.
Yes, unfortunately so. I really hope, you know, it wasn't always like that in our culture either. And I really hope we can get back to that communal feeling that some cultures still have, that we are to honor one another and help each other, that we are connected to each other, and let's not harm each other. I hope that we can get back to that, because it's heartbreaking to see what's going on in our country right now.
Let's talk about the soul of a woman. This was something that you offered in partnership with the folks at Rise Chattanooga over the summer.
Yeah, it was something that kind of developed along the way. I was asked to host it as we looked at really poetry, Black women and poetry. And of course, RISE exists to bring the arts primarily to marginalized communities such as African-American community and women, Latino community. And so they just asked me to host it, I think as a maybe a media personality, maybe someone who could communicate well. And then as we were looking at the poetry of Nikki Giovanni and Maya Angelou, in our discussions, we're connecting it back to our lives as women and as African-American women. And really, we started to talk about soul issues. We really went there with how does this affect your life, or can you connect yourself with this author and the things she's talking about? And it really became a cathartic thing for us. And so as we went on, and Shane said, hey, can you do some more of that? Can you weave in mental health, particularly with the arts, and come up with some things? I was like, wow, that's a fascinating concept. I think I was starting to do it without even realizing it, but he kind of made it present, like, let's weave this. And so then we did poetry of the Bible, and we looked at lament. We looked at lament poetry, the prophets, and Jeremiah, who's called the weeping prophet, and the Psalms where David is weeping and he's deeply depressed. And we examined those poems, and we talked about the way we were in the country today, and where were we lamenting and grieving things. And then we talked about love, and we explored love poetry, and we've talked about musical prodigies. So we kind of spun over into that, and we've looked at the lives of people who are creating some really amazing music out of painful circumstances in their lives. And then we took that into ourselves. And what are the ways in which we have had pain, and what beauty can we create out of that? What music can we create out of that? It is a creative way to teach mental health, really, how to express yourself, how to release emotion, how to have joy, how to see beauty. All of those are related to our mental health. And so it's been a joy to do it, and to do it in a community where we are less likely to seek counseling, African-American community particularly. We are much less likely to seek counseling. And so this is a way to bring counseling to people through the arts. And it's just fantastic.
This was baked into that poetry dating back millennia before there were the words mental health as we now associate them.
That's exactly right. Poetry is so cathartic and emotional. And, you know, I wrote poetry as a child. I don't really write it anymore, but I did write lots of poetry, even entered it in contests and writing contests. And it was a way for me to become, really, because a way for you to explore your feelings, understand yourself better, and become who you are, how to see the world even, and express it in a beautiful or creative way. And so it is like a way to have good mental health. Writing, any expression of the arts really is a way, is a path to having good mental health. I mean, it's not the whole story. Sometimes you do need a counselor or a psychiatrist or, you know, somebody professional. But when you create, something happens inside of you that sometimes is like a spiritual experience. It comes out of you and you don't even know that was in you. You discover and something blooms and you didn't even know how it got planted. And, you know, it's really just an amazing experience to create. And so it is something that can have a healing effect on our lives.
You've shared a few prominent names in poetry in the past few minutes. I'm just wondering, who inspires you, poet or beyond poetry?
Wow. Well, because I haven't really been into it as far as the study of it recently, but I would say Maya Angelou would have been one of those, because I actually had the privilege of seeing her perform her poetry as a young girl. I was in second or third grade. She came to Chattanooga and I didn't know who she was. I didn't know why we were going to see this woman. And they took us, they exposed us to her. We got to see her perform her poetry, and I never forgot her. You know, I literally met Maya Angelou on stage in elementary school and then realized how famous she was later, you know. So she's a huge influence. I read her stories. I know why the Caged Bird Sings and some of the other stories, biographies are, I guess, semi-autobiographies of her life, partial autobiographies of her life. And I resonated with her because she also lived in other countries and traveled and expressed herself in many different ways. You know, she was a dancer and, you know, she was a non-conventional woman. So I would say she was a huge influence. Growing up also, Margaret Walker was somebody I read a lot. I really enjoyed the things she shared in her books about Black culture in the South. And I'm trying to think of maybe some more modern influences. When I was in the Peace Corps, I did read African writers, and I had never done that before that I remembered. And so that was really interesting. I remember reading So Long a Letter. I think her name was Mariama Ba. She was Senegalese, so I read that when I was in Senegal, and she wrote about her husband taking a second wife. That's a reality, you know, that I was just learning about, you know, in this whole different culture where polygamy was practiced. But she talked about it from the perspective of somebody who was once in love with her husband and who didn't really want him to do that, and how that made her feel as a woman in that culture. And so it just really expanded my thinking about womanhood and marriage and all that, and culture. Those types of writers really have helped me.
What are you working on now?
Well, I wish I could say I was working on something. I'm working on getting started to work on something.
Okay.
I do work in media, so I guess every day I'm learning how to stay up on current events and speak into that from a spiritual perspective, because I do work in Christian radio right now. But I also am working on an idea with a friend who's a fellow counselor about doing some stuff on racial trauma and healing from that. So there's a few people out there doing that, but not a whole lot. We want to write about that and talk about that, maybe use media like Facebook, you know, videos to help African Americans and white Americans and other groups in America go inside and understand how race and on the tensions that we're seeing today and the history of our nation, how that's affected us personally, and how to move forward with that. Because I feel like in some ways, what we're seeing out in the streets, I just mean out there in public, you know, I guess it's being acted out what we feel on the inside, but I don't see a good solution happening or being presented to people to heal internally and be able to move forward internally. I feel like we need more conversation about that. So that's what I'm working on, I guess, right now.
And if people want more information about Rise Chattanooga, they can go to risechattanooga.org.
And on Facebook, Rise Chattanooga on Facebook. Yes.
And then beyond that, if people want more information about you and to keep up on you, where can they go online?
You could go to my media Facebook page, which is Tabi Upton Speaks. And I try to post what I'm doing in anything media. Or if I were speaking, I'm not really speaking anywhere now because of COVID, but speaking engagements in the future, and then what's happening with me on media, I try to post it on that Facebook page. I just started that this year. So Tabi Upton Speaks on Facebook.
All right, Tabi, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it so much.
Dr. Phyllis Miller grew up on a farmstead in Polk County, Tennessee. During her career in OBGYN medicine in this area, she became the first woman to head the Tennessee Medical Association. Author Linnell Mason tells that story in the biography, Climbing Mountains. Linnell, Phyllis, thanks for joining us.
Yes. Thanks for having us.
Phyllis, when did you decide to go into medicine?
Well, you know, I think it was in my genes, not a family of doctors, but I can't ever remember not wanting to be a doctor. So as far back as my memory goes.
And you grew up on a farmstead in Polk County, and you did a lot of this, so much of this on your own, because when you were in high school, you lost both of your parents.
I did it on my own in a lot of ways, but I had a lot of support from family and friends. It takes a village to raise a child is very true.
Teachers and mentors, and also scholarship money.
Yes, yes.
Working your way through college in the University of Tennessee School of Medicine, residency in Erlanger. When was that?
I started my residency in 1972. And we got paid a little bit then. I believe it was $10,000 a year, which seemed like a million.
And during your career in Chattanooga, caring for thousands of women, delivering thousands of babies.
That's correct. Actually, it's been 40 plus years. Hate to say that, but math. But it's been 40 plus years.
Along the way, your work was recognized.
Yes, and a lot was that I was at the right place at the right time. had mentors that nourished my career, helped me along.
And that includes the first woman to serve as president of the Chattanooga Hamilton County Medical Society, first woman president of the Tennessee Medical Association, first woman to serve as chief of staff at Erlanger Hospital. And you're still caring for patients.
Yes. Well, I've cut back to 2 days a week. I didn't think I was going to have that opportunity, but I knew I wasn't going to work like I had been. So I was preparing to retire, but an opportunity became available to work 2 days a week, which I was overjoyed with because I did not want to quit medicine. I love it.
And then how did you and Linnell meet?
Oh, Linnell and I are good friends. We first met in the Water Sunday School class at First Baptist Church.
Linnell, you worked for years as an elementary school educator in Georgia and for many years as a special education resource teacher.
Yes.
How did you get into writing and writing about Phyllis's life?
As a resource teacher, I often employed writing on a simpler level so that my children could grasp truths relative like to science that maybe in the fifth grade, the book said this, and I sought for a simpler way to express the same truths. Always enjoyed writing plays and things of that sort. Working with Phyllis was an entirely different thing. Of course, I had, under the guidance of Dr. John Pierce, written my own memoir back to the main thought about Phyllis. We had a retreat in a cabin that she and her brother built for her. We met in little groups, and I was anxious to explore the possibility of writing a children's book on her childhood because I saw elements in it I knew would be helpful to today's children also. I was drawn to Phyllis because of my background and her background synced together in that both of us were used to outdoor toilets and no lights and those kinds of things as children growing up. I was drawn to her honesty, her desire to really tell her story, but she just didn't feel that she had the technique of doing it.
What's something that might surprise people?
Telling this story has been purging for me. It's been a good thing to relive. And a lot of things I didn't remember as Linnell prodded me, they did come back to mind. But I think now a lot of people who know me or know of me now see me as this successful person and don't know anything about my background and that I have experienced very difficult circumstances. But what they see now is on the outside is not really the real me sometimes because I know where I came from.
I think that's definitely true. And it's also true in my own life. A lot of people don't know some of the things that I have dealt with. Anyway, it's therapeutic to be able to share oneself and to be open and honest. And I find that's an area where both of us sink together. We're not ashamed. We actually embrace our past, both the good and the bad, and have learned from it. It isn't always where you start out, it's where you end up. I just enjoy learning and hearing other people's stories and listening with my mind, but also with my heart. You know, I'm almost a few months shy of being 90, but I'm very much interested in learning and creating and relating to people.
Part of the proceeds from this book will be donated to the Polk County Education Foundation. Phyllis, you were one of the founders of that foundation. That foundation provides scholarships for deserving students in Polk County.
Many, many of us were involved in that effort. It was too big an effort for anybody to claim credit, but it's been a very successful organization, and it is a way of passing on to the next generation. We've got it set up to be a perpetual fund that will go on and something that's very satisfying to me and lots of other people.
All right. Phyllis, Linnell, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC.
Small Business Spotlight on WUTC. Every day, small businesses deliver for their customers and give locally. Here's Amanda Ellis of the Chattanooga Area Chamber of Commerce with today's guest.
So, Becky, thanks so much for joining us today. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about who you are, your company, and what you do?
So, I'm Becky Jackson. I'm the Vice President of Communications and Digital Marketing for North American Credit Services here in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
So, tell us a bit about your work in our community and how it's benefiting people, whether that be your employees or our entire community.
I think really one thing that we've made a real commitment to in the last, I'd say, 12 to 14 months is to educating our employees on the importance of diet and exercise. Unfortunately, our community here on campus has faced some severe illnesses, chronic conditions, and we've actually lost some employees to heart attacks or cancer or stroke. And we really wanted to change that curve and allow people to be able to be more informed. So we did something that was called Stretch for Success that actually allowed us to come into their workstations 3 times a day. And we would work with them while they're on their phones and they're continuing to be productive, but we would do certain stretches and exercises that would either get their heart pumping or would allow them to alleviate tension and stress in certain parts of their bodies. So when you work in a call center, oftentimes you're bending forward, you're on the phone, so your neck and your shoulders can get really tense. Your back sometimes can have poor support or poor posture. So we would work with them to develop certain stretches and exercises that would strengthen those core muscles and would allow them to have a little bit of relaxation as well while they're working from their desk. So the other thing that we added that was really beneficial was we did stand-up desk. So instead of it just being a sedentary position where you sit 6 to 8 hours every day, you actually can lift your desk whenever you would like to stand. And you can stand there, you can move your legs, you can walk around because they have headsets, so they're not physically attached to that desk. They can roam within a 2 feet radius. Some people even dance at their desk. They can do their sways, they can do some stretching, they can do some squats. So all of those different activities have allowed us to improve their overall lifestyle, but also educate them on the importance of getting up and moving and not just sitting and eating fast food every day.
Why did you decide to do that? And how do you see it making a difference?
So in 2019, our founder and owner, Dallas Benton Sr., passed away from heart condition. He had battled heart disease and cancer for many, many years. And when he passed away, we really felt like it was the time to say, hey, listen, don't let this happen to yourself. Don't let this happen to someone that you love. We don't want to lose anyone else on campus. We've actually had one employee who almost would have had a heart attack had he not known about his own condition because he's younger. And that really told us as a leadership team that we were ready as an employee base to make some real changes to what was happening on campus. And so in honor of Mr. Bunton, the board and the new owner, his wife Beverly, agreed to allow us to bring in exercise classes, yoga and Zumba, that came 4 times a week, and they paid for it for the employees to participate. And then they were the ones that said, hey, let's do these stand-up desks. Let's get these activity programs in line so that going into 2020 and beyond, our employees have a healthier lifestyle and they'll be with us long term.
Learn more at ChattanoogaChamber.com.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.